Council received instructions on what we expect in terms of argument. Any objection? Council may proceed.
May it please the court. Rebecca Copeland appearing on behalf of the state. At this time, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves a procurement contract entered into between the state and COGA for the widening of the highway in Hilo. The summary judgment issue for which the state has sought certiorari involves a claim for additional compensation made by COGA to remove an 18-inch water line at the project site, and that claim ultimately resulted in the majority of the monetary damages awarded against the state. Both the Circuit Court and the ICA concluded that the state waived a contractual notice requirement in which COGA was specifically required under Section 10518 of the party's contract to provide the state notice in writing within 30 days of any claim for additional compensation, within 30 days of when it had knowledge of that claim. COGA did not provide that notice, and for that reason, the ICA gravely erred in affirming the Circuit Court summary judgment orders. The ICA concluded specifically that because the state denied the claim on the merits and in its statement without reference to the notice deadline, the state had waived the 30-day notice requirement. However, that decision is completely contrary to the uncontroverted summary judgment evidence presented to the Circuit Court. Specifically, both the state's engineer and the Director of Transportation denied that claim both on the merits and because COGA did not meet the 30-day deadline. In the September 1st, 2000 letter in which the engineer denied COGA's claim for additional compensation, the engineer specifically stated that at the time COGA discovered the water line, notified the state, and submitted its revised work plan, there was, quote, no mention of the claim at that time. And in fact, when COGA appealed that decision to the Director of Transportation, COGA acknowledged that the lack of notice was one of the reasons its claim was denied. And again, in the June 29, 2001 letter in which the Director of Transportation affirmed that denial, the Director of Transportation indicated on several occasions that the denial was based on lack of notice. In fact, Section 4.2 of that denial letter is specifically entitled Failure to Provide Written Notice of Claim, and in detail concludes that the denial was based on COGA's failure to provide 30 days notice. COGA has argued to the Circuit Court and to the ICA that the state nevertheless waived the notice requirement because it denied the claim on the merits in addition to the notice. However, neither the cases cited by COGA nor those relied on the ICA stand for that proposition. What those federal cases stand for is the proposition that you cannot have the denial on the merits with absolutely no reference to the deadline. Because both the engineer and the Director of Transportation mentioned the 30-day deadline as having been busted by COGA, the state did not waive the notice requirement. However, in addition to the fact that the state did not waive the notice requirement, the ICA further erred in affirming the summary judgment orders because the state was prejudiced by COGA's lack of notice. Section 10518 goes on to require that if COGA does not give 30 days notice, and if the state is prejudiced by that late notification, then COGA's claim is barred. On summary judgment, the state presented the uncontroverted declaration of project engineer Salvador Panem. Mr. Panem specifically outlined the prejudice suffered by the state because of a more than 2-year delay in COGA's notification of the monetary claim for additional compensation. That prejudice was the inability to explore construction alternatives, suspending the project until after the water line was relocated, terminating the project either after the water line was discovered, after the revised work schedule was submitted, or after change order number 5 was agreed to, and it's unaware of the need to monitor the costs of the additional compensation. And monitoring the costs and allowing the state to monitor the costs was a specific requirement of 10518. COGA was required to afford the engineer with the proper facilities for keeping a strict account of those costs. Because of the delay, the state could not do so. And in fact, change order number 5, which COGA agreed to in March of 1998, was the contractual agreement between the parties that the total cost for relocating the water line would be $363,587. That figure was provided by COGA itself and incorporated into that change order. As the U.S. Copeland. Yes, sir.
Copeland.
Did COGA submit affidavits in opposition to the affidavits that the state submitted on prejudice?
COGA did not present any affidavit evidence that contravened Salvador Panem's declaration as to the prejudice suffered by the state. COGA did argue that the state was aware of the problem and therefore it was not prejudiced by the late notice. However, the U.S. Claims Court, which is the court in the federal arena that deals with these same types of contractual issues, has held in case after case for over 4 decades that awareness of the underlying facts does not equal awareness of the monetary claim itself. For example, in Eggers and Higgins versus the United States, the court applied prejudice as an equitable defense and concluded that because the contractor in that case provided notice over 5 years late, the government was substantially prejudiced by that late notice for the same reasons as here. Specifically, the inability to explore construction alternatives and being unaware of the need to monitor the costs.
I'm sorry, was there an affidavit by Mr. Sakamaki or something like that that indicated that state's officials were on the premises at all times and so they're aware of the problem with the water line and the work that COGA was doing?
There was an affidavit by Mr. Sakaitani, which indicated that aside from a few exceptions, state officials or its construction managers were present at the project at all times during COGA's work on the project. However, that blanket statement does not indicate what representatives were at the state at the time the specific work on the waterline problem was being worked on, or that there was a state inspector there who would be able to monitor the equipment or the time expended and to specifically keep track of the costs being expended by COGA for the waterline problem itself.
That was introduced to counter the state's position that it was prejudice.
On the awareness issue, yes, Your Honor.
On the what?
On the issue of whether or not the state was aware and therefore it was not prejudice. It did not specifically counter the items of prejudice that Salvador Panem explained, for example, inability to suspend the project or terminate it at certain times or explore construction alternatives, which could have reduced the costs that were ultimately claimed by COGA.
I'm sorry, you had engineers from the state present.
Excuse me?
You had engineers from the state that were present on the site.
That's
what you're talking about.
The evidence indicates that there were construction managers on the site at various times and possibly the engineer, but it doesn't outline specifically who was at the site by the state and at what specific time. So I'm not aware of any evidence in the record that specifically states that there was an engineer on site for the entire time the project was being completed, or specifically with regard to summary judgment when the waterline issue was being completed.
the water line issue was determined to be in existence, was it apparent that there needed to be extra work done?
Yes, it was. And in fact, because when COGA discovered it at the beginning, actually near the beginning of its work, and notified the state, because it was apparent that there needed to be extra work, the state specifically asked COGA for a proposal of how much it would cost for them to relocate the water line. And it was COGA's proposal that was for the $363,000 figure. And as explained by the state's engineer in his denial of the claim at the first tier denial level, the indirect costs, which are customarily included in the unit or lump prices for each contract and extra work, are customarily included in a change order. COGA did not provide any indirect costs in its proposal with its figure, which was ultimately incorporated into the change order. That was COGA's responsibility to provide that to the state, not the state's responsibility. And therefore, the state was still prejudiced by COGA's late notification. And for that reason, the ICA also should have reversed the circuit court summary judgment orders.
So the issue of prejudice was decided on summary judgment.
It was. And the confusion may come in that prejudice came up at both the summary judgment level and the trial level. However, at summary judgment, it went to whether or not the notice provision would be applied in this case, whereas similar declarations were submitted by Mr. Panum at trial on the prejudice suffered by the state as to what their damages would be ultimately in the case. But definitively, the issue of whether or not COGA's claim should have gone forward to begin with was decided on summary judgment. If the court has no further questions, then the state would...
I have one question.
Okay.
So, under 105.18, whether or not writing or notice is given in a timely manner, the contract provisions provide for later notification. Is that correct?
If later notification shall not prejudice the claim unless the state, shall not bar the claim unless the state is prejudiced by that late notice. And that's why prejudice is key as to whether or not COGA's claim should have gone forward to begin with.
So all these questions about waiver all come down to the question of whether there was prejudice, because the contract provides that even if there's late notification, that does not bar a claim unless the state is prejudiced.
That's correct, Your Honor. For these reasons, the state would respectfully request that this court reverse that portion of the ICA's SDO in which it affirmed the circuit court's summary judgment orders. Thank you.
Chief Justice Moon, Justices, and Judge Kim, may it please the court. I would like to address the issues, first of all, having to do with the retention issue, and I believe that the facts that relate to that relate to the case in chief. It is not a situation where you will find that the state made any effort to work with a contractor in this situation, and the facts and the findings of facts would tend to establish that. I would think that there are a number of key points that are established by the record and by the conclusions of law. COGA first informed the state that it was substantially complete with the project on October 4th of 1999 and asked for final payment. Further, the state of Hawaii, based upon conclusion to law 163, and stated that the state had full use of the project from 1999 for 6.5 years. There's no indication that any additional work was required by the state in order to obtain that additional use. The state never issued a notice of final acceptance. No evidence was ever presented by the state that additional work was required by the state to complete the project. The state, while it had the opportunity, and counsel for the state has so acknowledged, had the right at any time to suspend or terminate the work, if it needed to find out more about the project. That was not done. The COGA lawsuit was filed in December of 2001. Now, subsequent to the notification of substantial completion, the inspection by the state indicated that there was amount of work to be done, certain amount of punch list work. COGA then proceeded to correct the non-conforming work and advise the state of its completion on December 2nd of 2004 and requested that it be paid consistent with the terms of the contract. At the second final inspection conducted by the state on December 9th of 2004, the state again indicated some punch list work of a lesser level and proposed giving COGA a rebate for the non-conforming items. COGA rejected the rebate, and thereafter, at a subsequent inspection by the state issued a progress payment report number 16 dated December 14th, 2004, wherein the state admitted that the work completed on that project at that time amounted to 100% completion of the project. This is finding of fact 311 and 312. The state did not thereafter ever issue any decision pursuant to COGA's request for final payment, even after there had been a determination by the state's own engineer that 100% of the work had been completed. Just so we are clear, and I'm sure you understand, that the definition of retention in this circumstance is that during the course of a contract, the contractor earns a certain amount of money for completing its work. The state, under the terms of the contract, has the right to retain some of those funds until the project is completed. At that point, the money that has been earned is then turned over and paid to the contractor. In this case, there was never any decision issued by the state pursuant to 103D, Section 703, sub C. In this situation, it would be pointed out that the state not only failed to pay any sum of the retention, even though its own officers had suggested a sum of approximately $82,000, and the state further did not provide any decision or guidance to the contractor as to the reasons for its failure to pay, consistent with 103D 703. I would point out a number of key findings of fact, which apparently have not been disputed. 302 concludes that the state has not paid COGA for the retention of the project, which totals $145,250, and that's Exhibit P244. Finding of fact 311, in the state's progress payment number 36, dated December 14th, 2004, Mr. Panham admitted that the work completed is 100%. That's Exhibit P130. Finding of fact 312, COGA should be paid its retention because COGA completed the requirements of the contract. Conclusions of law 162, since October 1st, 1999, COGA has substantially completed the project and the state has had full use of the project. Conclusions of law 168, even the $82,487.89 in retention that the state admits should be paid to COGA has not been paid. It is our position, first of all, that 103D, subsection 703 and 704 should be strictly construed if it eliminates claims on parties who have substantial damages. I would point out that Section A defines what a controversy is. It goes into Section B. And it says, by virtue of a contract between them, including without limitations, controversies based upon breach of contract, mistake, misrepresentation, or other causes for contract modification. With regards to the retention issue, there has been no controversy as to what the facts are. First of all, there's an admission that all of the work has been completed, 100% has been completed. There's no controversy as to what the amount is. It is our position that the retention issue is outside the contract for several reasons. One, the state has refused to ever issue a decision. Now, while the contractor may have had the right to assume that this was a denial, there were so many factors in play with regards to the retention, including trying to incorporate the 100% completion, that there was no guidance ever given by the state as to why they were not paying or what their decision was with regards to the completion of the contract and the monies due under that contract. You just had a refusal to pay, which was even inconsistent with their own internal proposal that the $82,000 should be paid. It is our position, therefore, that strictly construing 103D, 703, and 704, that this particular situation, and if you read Poe and you read Hokama, which I'll discuss, do not fall within the purview of 103D703. In addition, on the cases that we have cited, particularly remanufacturing, if the state wishes to take the benefit of the clause requiring that we have taken advantage of 103D703 and 704 and should not have the right to retention because we did not exhaust the administrative remedies, it would say that the burden is upon the state to prove that they fit within the right to claim that we are not entitled to this claim. If you take this further and you read Poe v. Hawaii, basically it says that if the situation is one where proceeding with an administrative claim is not one that would amount to a remedy and would be an exercise in futility, that this provision would not apply. The plaintiff Poe was a public employee represented by the HGEA. The collective bargaining agreement governing Poe's employment provided for a five-step grievance procedure, one informal step followed by four formal grievance steps. The last formal step was arbitration, which was only something the HGEA could initiate. Because the claimant in that situation did not have the ability to initiate the fourth step, this court found that the application of the requirement to exhaust remedies did not exist and they could proceed with his claim. The similarity in that case and this case is that we are being placed and were placed in a situation where the state has used this project for 6.5 years. They have acknowledged that the retention was money earned by its very definition. They refused to issue an order consistent with 103D, 703C. There is no guidance given to the contractor as to the basis upon which he can appeal. And they do not pay any of the money, even the sums that are due according to their own engineer. We're saying, first of all, that we would fall under the Poe case, that we do not fall within the purview of 103D703 for the reasons that we do not find ourselves in a situation where there is any controversy. There may be a controversy as to why they paid or why they did not pay. We have no idea what the state was thinking. All we know is that the contractor was getting stiffed on that point. They were getting no guidance and no decision was ever issued. We'd also like you to look at Hokama, which we cited. And this was a case where the UH moved for and was awarded summary judgment on the grounds that Hokama had failed to exhaust its administrative remedies.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kobayashi.
Yes, Justice Hokama.
The state says a check for $86,000 was forwarded to Koga. I might be wrong, but and they said, but it was not cashed. Can you explain the circumstances of that?
I can only tell you, Your Honor, that I did not have the opportunity to try the case. In reading through the record and the conclusions of law and the findings of fact, there was no payment of the retention, even the 82,000, and that was a finding of the ICA, and I believe the Circuit Court also. So I apologize, I cannot answer that particular question. I read that from the record. Going back to Hokama, on appeal, the Hawaii Supreme Court affirmed the Circuit Court's award of summary judgment, finding that Hokama was bound by the grievance procedures contained in his collective bargaining agreement. However, the court also noted that the grievance procedure contained in the CBA was no longer available to Hokama, since it required that any grievance be filed within 20 calendar days of the date of the alleged violation. The court said that exhaustion requirements aims to redirect grievances for their proper resolution, not to preclude them altogether. The court then said, "We are compelled to excuse Dr. Hokama's failure to previously pursue his damage claims in the administrative forum. At the time of his initial grievance, Dr. Hokama understandably focused his concern on securing the representation due him under the agreement in the first instance, rather than seeking immediate compensation for expenses already incurred. Dr. Hokama's decision not to administratively contest the university's later denials representation was also not unreasonable insofar as he had already resorted to the administrative process and had indeed received an apparent definitive ruling. Similarly, due to the failure of the state to respond to the request for a decision even after its own engineer found in favor of the project, and that the project had been 100% complete, there was no ability to proceed with the administrative proceedings, and the litigation was already underway in the civil case. The court also found that the failure to meet time deadlines within these circumstances as mandated by the administrative procedures was not valid. It is our position in summary that with regards to the issue for which we were directed to prepare a supplemental memorandum as to whether 103D703 mandated that we comply with the administrative procedures and therefore dictated the issue of jurisdiction. We believe that it does not apply, that the Circuit Court had jurisdiction, that this court does have jurisdiction on the basis of, one, by definition of controversy, we do not fit. Secondly, this is a situation where the state has exacerbated the situation and created a problem where the contractor could not proceed. It had no response or no reply to the issue of completion. It had no indication as to why it was not being paid. All that you have was an issue of non-payment. Based upon Poe and upon Hokama, we believe that this is an extension of that line of thinking. 103D is not to exclude claims, it's to redirect them. We believe that it is not designed to eliminate claims of this nature and that jurisdiction was proper. Thank you.
May it please the court. 103D of the Procurement Code is mandatory in this case and deprived the Circuit Court of jurisdiction over the retainage issue. Specifically, 103D711A provides that only parties to the contract that are aggrieved by a decision issued pursuant to 103D703 may initiate an action under 661-1. There was no final decision under 103D703 because COGA never invoked the administrative process under Chapter 103D and specifically Sections 103D703A and sequence. 103D703A applies those administrative procedures to all controversies between the government body and the contractor that arise under or by virtue of the contract, including breaches of contract. COGA's argument that the state did not properly pay retainage is a breach of contract argument, and therefore falls squarely under that broad definition of controversy. That section goes on to allow the chief procurement officer to engage in those informal settlement processes and provides that if that section is invoked, the chief procurement officer will issue a final decision. It is that final decision that must be issued before an aggrieved party can file a lawsuit. There was no final decision because COGA did not invoke the statute. Instead of addressing the mandatory nature of 103D itself, COGA assumes today in oral argument, as it always has, that the statute applies, and instead argues two equitable reasons why it should not be applied to it. First, that there's no controversy. However, the retainage issue does fit within the broad definition of controversy. Because it does so, that and there was no final decision, the circuit court did not have jurisdiction. COGA also argues that equitably the statute shouldn't be applied because the pursuit of the administrative remedies would have been futile. However, the record does not support that in this case. What the record actually shows is that the state issued progress payment number 36, and this court can look to trial exhibit P130, one of COGA's own exhibits, to see progress payment number 36. That was the payment by the state in which it attempted to pay approximately $82,000 of the $145,000 retainer. That in and of itself shows that had COGA invoked the administrative process, it would not have been futile. COGA instead argues in its briefing that there was some preordained result because it, I guess, did not believe that the state would actually issue the retainage, but that evidence of progress payment 36, and in addition, the state's offer of a 10% rebate on the remaining $62,000 shows that that is not correct. In other words, Your Honors, the state has offered to pay COGA almost 90% of that retainage amount, and COGA has never acted to accept either progress payment number 36 or the 10% rebate offer.
The 10% rebate would be that the state would keep 10%.
Would keep 10%. That's correct. Right. So the
How did the state offer to pay the $82,000? What did it do?
The state, for the $82,000 on December 14, 2004, issued progress payment number 36. Under the terms of the contract, progress payments were allowed to be issued periodically over the project period for work that COGA had completed. Once,
Did it mail a check? I'm asking, what did it do?
Excuse me?
Did it mail a check for $82,000?
It issued the progress payment, and COGA was then needed to then accept that progress payment so that a check could be issued, I believe, Your Honor. But it never returned the progress payment, which was its obligation once the state issued number 36.
So what happened, excuse me, after all of this? It just, people just stopped doing anything? Is that?
Apparently. The parties couldn't agree to COGA never accepted project payment number 36 or the 10% rebate, and this, understand, was all occurring after the lawsuit had been filed on the retainage issue. So the original complaint in this case was on the issues related to claim for additional compensation. Once the retainage issue came up, the offers were made by the state, and COGA never responded, and because that was during the lawsuit itself, at some point the retainage issue became part of trial, and the trial court issued findings related to that. And I see I have about 5 minutes. The evidence presented at trial did not show that COGA's work that it was required to complete under the contract was conforming to the contract. And Section 10512 required that the engineer consider work not, quote, conforming to the contract as being unacceptable. In this case, after two inspections, the engineer concluded that there were outstanding punch list items that were never and have never been completed by COGA. A punch list item, by definition, is nothing more than construction work that is incomplete or unacceptable and therefore must be completed before final payment can be made. That did not occur in this case, and in fact, the circuit court issued findings and conclusions that those outstanding punch list items had never been completed. Progress payment number 36 did note that the work was 100% complete, but that progress payment does not support COGA's arguments for several reasons. First, a notation in a progress payment that the work is 100% complete is not the same as a conclusion by the engineer post-inspection that all of the contract work is conforming to the contract. In fact, under the party's contract, progress payments are only estimates. The dollar amounts are estimates, and the percentage complete are just estimates. In addition, progress payment number 36 itself acknowledges that there are still outstanding punch list items that have not been completed by COGA. And finally, progress payment number 36 is subject to revision until there's a final estimate. That has not occurred in this case, and there has been no final acceptance of this contract because COGA has never completed all of the work it was obligated to under the contract, conforming to the contract. And in addition, COGA is not entitled to retainage because, as recognized by the ICA, its pleadings in this case were insufficient. It never requested damages for retainage in either its discovery responses, its expert report, or its complaint. And despite ample opportunity to do so, it never amended that complaint at trial. Because it did not, the pleadings themselves do not support the circuit court's conclusion that COGA was entitled to retainage.
Well, you filed a motion in limine to preclude evidence of retainage, so you knew that that was going to be an issue because it had been covered in discovery.
Yes, Your Honor. Some questions had come up in discovery related to the retainage issue, so there was always some slim possibility that the issue might have come up in trial, which is why the state filed the motion in limine. However, under this court's precedent, consent to that unpleaded issue would have been implied by the state had it not objected to the potential of that evidence.
And the court overruled your motion in limine, which meant that the retainage issue would be tried.
That's correct.
So you had notice that it was going to be tried.
Well, we had noticed that they would be able to present evidence, not specifically that they would seek that as part of their damages.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand it. You understood, or the state understood, that there would be
that there was
coming into the issue of retainage, which would be part of a claim for payment, right?
That there was a possibility that that some evidence on retainage would be submitted, but not that they would ultimately seek damages based on retainage, which is what the circuit court granted them, $145,000 in retainage damages. And even beyond the complaint issue, because the evidence itself did not support that they completed all the work, they still wouldn't have been entitled to retainage anyway. For these reasons, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm that portion of the ICA's SDO in which it reversed the circuit court's retainage damage award. Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor. I don't know what the distinction is that is being sought with regards to retention and retention damage. I am also aware that this is not a court that's going to review the facts to make a finding of facts, but we're beyond that point, and I don't think it's appropriate that we're up here arguing facts that the court should have interpreted relative to these issues unless it goes beyond some standard which has not been articulated. I would point out that with regards to retention, that finding of fact 302 specifically states that the state has not paid COGA the retention for the project. There's no retention damages, it's retention. And that amount is found to be $145,250. So whatever distinction is being sought as to damages is not correct. That is a retention amount. State Council also said that with regards to the issue of the inspections, that there were two inspections. The first found a number of punch list items. The second found a lesser amount of punch list items. And then she said there was an acknowledgement at some point that 100% of the work had been completed. What was not said is that the finding of 100% completed work on a project was after, at least by a week or two, after the second finding that some punch list items remained. After the finding of 100% complete, there was never any indication by any record submitted by the state that indicated that any part of the work required under the contract had not been performed. So that you have to have the time sequence when you look at the argument she just presented.
Mr. Kobayashi, was the notation that 100% completion, was that on a progress payment?
That was on a progress payment, and that specifically was finding of fact 311, state's progress payment number 306, dated December 14th, 2004. Mr. Panham, who is one of the engineers for the state, admitted that the work completed is 100%.
And did the progress payment indicate there were any further items on the punch list that needed to be done?
I'm afraid I didn't.
Did the progress payment notation also note whether there are further items on the punch list that needed to be completed?
No, Your Honor. There was no such indication. I'm sure the state would have been the first to raise that issue. She says that while progress payments may or not be indicative of a final position, this is sworn testimony coming out of their expert as to what the status of the work was on December 14th, 2004. The final point is that as to whether the retention was paid or not paid, no matter what factual argument is being presented at this point in time, you have finding of fact, conclusion of law 168, which specifically says that even the $82,487.89 in retention that the state admits should be paid to COGA has not been paid. That's the conclusion of the court, the trier of the fact, after hearing all of the evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
The court thanks both counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. The Supreme Court is giving away.